Welcome to the Savoy Originals. I'm Alex Zane, and this week I am joined by a bona fide national treasure with a trophy cabinet bursting at the seams with medals from her incredible career as a competitive swimmer and one of the world's greatest ever Paralympians. Today, we talk about that phenomenal journey, her move now into becoming a BAFTA-winning documentary maker, and how the various strands of her life have only just come together in the last few years.
We found out that there's so many children with a disability in the care system, so I felt like there was a responsibility on me with the platform that I'd had from swimming to use my voice to hopefully help so many children with a disability in the care system.
My guest today is, of course, the brilliant Ellie Simmons, and this is the Savoy Originals. Ellie, wonderful to have you here. You are one of the world's most celebrated Paralympians with 5 gold medals. That's alongside 14 world titles, 10 European titles, countless records smashed. You've got an MBE, a BAFTA, and to top it all off, you won Cooking with the Stars. A perfect time to say cheers.
Oh, thank you so much. Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers. Oh. That's lovely.
It's all right, isn't it?
Yeah, that's really nice.
The Savoy Originals is supported by Laurent Perrier, one of the great innovators of the Champagne region. And as Ellie takes her place in our penthouse suite here at the Savoy, we are toasting her success with a bottle of Laurent Perrier Heritage, their latest release, something you can do at the Savoy too. But right now, let's get back to room 214. That is quite a list of achievements I just read out. What is it like when you hear that back?
It doesn't feel like it's me. Being an athlete and, well, now being retired for 4 years, I think I've got that naturalness of I'm always looking for the next thing.
And do you think you don't take that moment to pause it and look back over what you've achieved because of the mentality you had to have as a competitive swimmer where you are constantly working towards the next race?
Oh, very much so. I think that's my personality too. But I think when I was that swimmer, like it was a 4-year cycle, 4 years for the Paralympics, year for either World Championships or Europeans. I knew where I've got to be every single week with training and a day plan. And I think I was like that when I was a kid as well. Like my mum always says, if I was the first, I would have been the last because I could never sit and down and watch TV and be on the sofa. Like I always had to be doing something.
Well, this seems like a great opportunity to talk about your childhood, because obviously it'd be interesting to go on this journey to see where the spark happened. This is Val and Steve Simmons. I recall at the BAFTAs, they were the very first people you thanked in your speech. You're obviously still very close. As a kid, what was the ethos that they instilled in you that really drove you on your way?
Being happy. And I think swimming made me really happy because that's what they focus on. Being a happy person makes for happy being an athlete, being in sport, being in life, and confidence as well. My sister also has dwarfism, and my other sister has a type of disability, intellectual impairment, like Down syndrome. So we've been very much aware of what the world is like with being different and having different disabilities and using that in a positive way, not using it in a negative way to make us think that we can't do anything or make the world feel sorry for us. They've enhanced it and thought that we can do anything no matter what. So I think being confident in myself and in the family, and we're very family orientated as well. Like I'm from a big family. We've got 3 sisters and 1 brother. We're very family orientated, and I've spoken about my journey a lot recently and since doing the documentary with ITV, Finding My Secret Family, which I'm going to bring it up so many times at one of BAFTA, which again, a massive highlight.
And you should. Yeah. It's fantastic.
Oh, thank you so much. Because I think before that, I didn't really want to talk about my adoption when I was an athlete because I wanted my sport to be the focus and not other stuff to be the talking point. I knew I was adopted and I knew I had this family that I've never met before. And growing up, I've always had these questions. Like I remember growing up, I loved the story of Tracy Beaker, which was on CBBC, and Tracy Beaker is in a foster home and she talks about being in care. And I felt like there was a connection between me and her, even though I'd been brought up so well with my parents and my family and we've been so open. But there's always these questions that you've got in the back of your mind, like, what is my birth mom like? Is she this famous person or is she this, like, what is she? And, you know, when you go to the doctors or... they always ask you questions of like, have you got any medical history? And I could say, I don't know, because I didn't know if I'd got any medical history in my family. I've got, yeah, all these questions like, who do I look like? Do I look like my mom? Do I look like my dad? Where's my hair like from? Where's my eyes? Like, all these questions.
I mean, to read about it, it sounds like you had a fairly idyllic childhood. Val and Steve were, by the sounds of things, able to provide you with everything you want. You had a pony?
Yeah, we did. Yeah, I was very lucky. It was like a farm in our house, really. We had so many animals. Like, my sister had a horse, I had a pony. We had birds, we had hamsters, guinea pigs.
As well as what sounds like a wonderful menagerie of animals, you also had a heated swimming pool at the bottom of the garden. Now, unless I'm thinking of a different Walsall, I'm guessing there weren't a lot of other houses with heated swimming pools at the bottom of the garden.
I don't think so. Do you know what? I don't remember much of that pool because we left the house like when I was maybe like 6, 7. But I remember, yeah, being in like a wooden cabin at the bottom of the garden. We were outside all the time. Like, we had lots of grass. I remember like that we had a Wendy house, a trampoline. My parents were, yeah, very sociable, and they used to do, like, my mum was on the adoption course, there was always someone there, and I loved that growing up. Like, the house was always busy and there was always new people in and out, and yeah, I really enjoyed that, and I think that's made me, in a way, all of us in a way, quite sociable.
So this is leading me on to my question, which is, when the love of swimming first hit you, and was it a eureka moment? Did you get in the pool for the first time and go, oh my gosh, this is what I want to do forever? What happened the first time you got in a pool?
I think I learned to swim at the age of 5. I remember watching my sister swim and sitting at the sideline, you know, when you get dragged to all your older siblings' like activities. I remember sitting watching, and then next thing I know, it was my turn to learn to swim at the age of 5. And where we learned was in Windley, but it was also a swimming club too. It was Bolmere Swimming Club. Mm. And it had a learn to swim side, but also a competitive side as well. The coach at the time, Ashley Cox, came to the learn to swim section and would like talent spot in a way and say, oh, you could come and swim maybe for the swimming club. So I progressed with him. And my swimming took over, so it was like twice a week, 3 times a week, and all my other activities would get less and less, and swimming would take over. So it wasn't a sport where I was thinking, oh, this is what I'm good at. It was just a natural thing that I just enjoyed it. And just, I remember going home saying, Ashley said, if I want to be a better swimmer, I've got to do more sessions. So all my other activities would get less and less, and swimming would take over. And I think another thing that I loved about swimming is I would always get to the pool 30 minutes before a session to play around and mess around. And I was always the last to leave the session because I would be messing around and playing around in the changing room. So for me, swimming was more not just because I enjoyed it, learning to swim, but the friend side as well. I was swimming at Able-Bodied Swimming Club, so against non-disabled swimmers. So I didn't realise how good I actually was. And I was swimming at the weekend, at the galas, the local Diddy League galas on a Saturday.
It sounds like quite a commitment for a child, though, because you were getting up 5:30 a.m. 5 mornings a week to do 2 hours training before your lessons and then another 90 minutes afterwards. Was that all Ellie Simmons? Was that you going, I want to be getting up at 5:30 in the morning at that age?
Yeah, so at the time I was swimming, yeah, 3 times a week after school. And watching Athens 2004 Paralympics, as a 9-year-old, sitting on that sofa, I remember saying to my mom, how old do you have to be to go to the Paralympics? And she was like, oh, any age. You just have to be really good. And that's when my light switched and I was like, I want to go to a Paralympics. And you never think sometimes, like when you have these epiphany moments or inspirational moments, that it's actually going to happen. But yeah, to think 4 years later, I ended up going to my first one. But that moment, that was when we realised disability sport was there. So December of 2004, I went to my first disability gala and got talent spotted. from British Swimming. They were there on the sidelines and they thought I was actually really good. Again, I'd never compete against disabled people, so I didn't know actually how good I was, because competing against AB people, I was last all the time. I wasn't that good, but I was doing it for the friendship, the fun. So going to that first gala in Swansea in 2004, I was like, wow, I'm winning, like I'm doing all right. Like I remember getting a medal, and the medal, Nairi Lewis presented me with the medal, who was the lady that inspired me on the TV in Athens. She was also Essex, got the gold medal in Athens. And it was just like, I met the most famous person ever. Like I was just so starstruck. She was presenting me with my medals.
I want to move into your career as a Paralympian and some of the achievements and some of the struggles that came with those achievements. But before we go there, as we sit here now, you are obviously a legendary athlete with an incredible legacy in an arena that is tough and unforgiving. So why do you think you've succeeded where so many haven't?
I think it's the whole package. The personality helps. Being competitive, being driven, working hard. You know, I think being a athlete, you're pushing your body to its limits every single day. You know, when you wake up and you're aching, You've got to ignore that ache and still go to the gym or still go to the swimming pool and still push your body. So I think the mental aspect is one of the biggest things, but also the team around you as well. The support system has really, really helped me. My swimming coach, Billy Pye, who was my coach when I moved to him back in 2006 to when I retired when I was 26. He was everything to me. He was my coach. He was my second dad. He was my best friend. He was someone there that if I wanted to have a cry on his shoulder, I could have a cry on his shoulder. But if I needed him to be tough, he would be tough. I was so lucky that I found my talent at such a young age. Like we find our talent in so many different times, so many different areas, but I was lucky that I found that I was good at swimming at the age of 12, 13.
You said something really interesting earlier about how you wanted the narrative, let's call it, when you were competing as a Paralympian, to be about the sport, and you didn't want to talk about your personal life, your history, your birth mother, being adopted. Was that because you felt that it would pull focus for you from the competitive edge that you needed in the pool? I mean, for example, you obviously didn't know your birth mother at that point. You hadn't met. Was there a fear that she might emerge from the darkness, if you will, and go, yeah, and that would suddenly be the story?
Yeah, very much so. As an athlete, you've got to be very selfish. You want to try and limit the distractions, because one little thing that could affect you mentally could become a massive ripple effect in the water. So I really wanted to have those, like a horse, you know, when they go racing, they've got the blinkers on. I just wanted to full focus of being the best athlete that I could be and just fully focus on swimming with less distractions, because I knew I had pressure on me and I was trying to deal with the pressure with 2012, one of the faces of the games in London. It's a big ask to go out there at the Paralympics and get a gold medal.
Obviously, that wasn't your first Paralympics. 2008, the youngest member of Team GB, 13 years old. You'd go on to win 2 gold medals. How much do you think being 13 actually contributed to those wins?
Oh, hugely. It was my first Games. I didn't know what I was going in for. We didn't even expect even to qualify. Our focus was on London 2012. My competitors weren't focusing on me. They were focusing on each other. And that's one of the, looking back now at my 100 metres freestyle, the first ever gold medal that I got at the Paralympics. And I was just coming in on the sidelines and they just weren't looking at me at all. So that really, really helped. Again, probably people thought maybe this big occasion will affect me mentally, all that type of stuff. But also another positive of being so young is I was just going to China on a summer holidays and just, you know, going to swim as fast as I could. So actually being so young, you deal with the pressure, but you don't think about it. You're just a 13-year-old, a kid, just going to go and represent her country, yes, but just do the sport that she loves. Like, so whereas when I was 17 in London, I could feel the pressure. As a 13-year-old, you just, you're young, aren't you? You're just a kid at the end of the day. So I think so many things just worked and was put in place for the right time, the right occasion. So to come away with two gold medals, gosh, I would never expect that. Like watching Athens 2004 and then thinking 4 years later I was going to Beijing, two gold medals. And yeah, it was just, it was the most incredible games.
This is interesting because obviously your win and the coverage of the Beijing Paralympics, I mean, it cemented you in the nation's heart. So outside of the sport, did things change for you?
I wanted to make sure they didn't change. That's what I loved about school. Like I could just go back. They did want a celebration for me back in Beijing. And I didn't want one. I remember coming in with a limousine and I was able to bring my school friends with me and we went around the school and I showed them my medals, all that. So at least we got it out the way in a day and then I could just go back to school the next day normally.
I guess another celebration would have been you becoming the youngest ever person at 14 to receive an MBE presented to you by the Queen. How was that? What did she say? Did she say anything?
It was the most amazing day. When I got the letter from through the post, I didn't know what it was. Like, I didn't have a clue what an MBE was. I just remember seeing this envelope with the Royal Crest on it and just opening it. And then I just tossed it to my mum and she had a look at it and was like, wow, Ellie, it's an MBE, like member of the British Empire. This is like a huge honour. Like, wow, this is incredible. So I never really took it in what it was. I was just more excited to go to Buckingham Palace, like, and get dressed up. And it was just wonderful to be able to go through the gates. And what was another incredible, wonderful thing was I was able to take my grandma, and she's exactly the same age as the Queen, and for her growing up, like seeing the Queen and watching like the coronation and all that, like we were just so excited to live all of that through her eyes. So I think that was one of the most amazing things, was just to take my grandma to meet the Queen. And I remember saying to my mum, oh, she was just like grandma, she's just like you, grandma. And yeah, it was so nice to have like the photos. And afterwards, we went for afternoon tea, and that was really, really nice, a celebration, and yeah, just a wonderful time to celebrate all my achievements.
You've spoken already about London 2012 and being slightly older, being 17, the pressure increasing, and you were very much the poster girl for those Paralympics in both the literal and figurative sense. There were huge posters of you everywhere, which must have been, I don't know, I guess on the one hand perhaps buoyed you up and gave you an extra, you know, oomph for the games, but could have been a distraction at the same time.
Yeah, I think you're right, Alex. I think I look back sometimes and I think, how did I cope with that pressure? Because it was immense. As soon as January the 1st of 2012 came, I was like, you watch the fireworks on London and the countdown and the excitement was going to be, I want to be able to stand behind that block with no regrets. And my mind switched and I was like, I'm going to do everything in training. I'm going to push my body every single day. I'm going to eat the right food. I'm going to, you know, be selfish. I'm going to do all of this. And so I had that confidence, and the confidence really, really helped. But April of that year of 2012, was going in, world record holder. We just hit our trials for the games, qualified. It was in the Olympic pool to be able to test that out. All these amazing benefits you get that of being a home games, being able to soak up the environment, know what you're getting in for. But after those trials in April, a new competitor came on the scene, American, Victoria Arlen. Mm. And she hit the world record. And I remember seeing the time, because as a competitor, you watch what the whole world is doing, you know, every single person, all your competitors, what they're doing in training, like you get quite obsessed. Mm. She came out the blue. Mm. Like I'd not seen her one bit. She hit the world record, but she did it by a long, long way. And I was thinking, gosh, Simmers. I remember actually crying when I saw the time and thinking, gee, this is, I'm going in to a home games, home pressure, was supposed to be the favorite, done everything that I'd done and achieved, and then there's an American come out the woodwork, got the world records. I had my moment to cry, got all my emotions out, and actually I was like, I want to beat her. Yeah. I think it really like motivated me. And the first race, I think it was day three of the of London 2012. So I'd been able to watch the Olympics, see the likes of Mo Farah, Jess Ennis, Greg Rutherford do Super Saturday, get super, super motivated. Us Paralympians, we always say the Olympics are the warm-up for us. You know, they're able to nail everything. If there's any things going wrong, the Olympic organising committee can sort it all out, ready for the Paralympics. So we knew it was going to be a big game seeing the Olympics. So I was excited, motivated. But again, the back of my mind, I've got this American to beat. So day three, 400 metres freestyle. Had the most amazing heat swim. I'd done a massive personal best, hit a Paralympic record. But I still not raced Victoria Ireland because she was in the heat after me, so I still didn't know what she could swim, but I knew I was in good form. I got the nerves out of the way, got the feel of the water, and then the heat, the final came the evening. I remember sitting in the core room, which is where your seven other competitors are, so it's just you, 20 minutes before a race. You've done your warm-up, you've done all the process, had my coffee, had my caffeine, everything that I needed. I was fully mentally prepared, physically prepared, ready to go. Gave Billy a hug. That's what we always do. We always give each other a hug and we always say, see you on the other side. It's like the thing that we always say every single race, see you on the other side. And then 20 minutes, you're in the core room and everyone's doing their little things, you know. You've got some people singing, you've got some people mentally trying to distract you, you've got so many things. And it's, I just listened to my music, just breathe. And I was sitting next to Victoria and she was doing her race routine and she was, I could tell she was trying to like distract me because a lot of mind games happen.
I bet.
But I was just, I knew that I was like, come on Simmons, focus on yourself. I was listening to Eminem, that's the last song I listened to, Lose Yourself. And you're thinking,
of course, literally.
And my name called and I walked out and 17,500 people cheering. I knew that normally I listen to music fully, like, but I had one headphone out to fully focus on not just the music but the crowd, to use them, because British crowds, I wanted to use that, the excitement, the buzz, all of this. And I stood behind the block and I was shaking. I've never shaken standing, like, I was so, so nervous. And my race plan was, Billy was, so 400 metres, eight lengths, I'm an Olympic size swimming pool, which is a long way. His race plan was keep on Victoria's arms and legs, hot body, sorry, for the 200 metres and then overtake her. So that was my race plan. So listen to the start blocks, referee, take your marks, go, dive in. All the nerves, once you're in the water, just go. It's you and that water, all that training, all that hard work for that moment. You're pushing your bodies to its limits, but you know you can because of all that training that you've done. So the 200 metres goes, she's beaten me, she's ahead of me on that 200 metres. I knew, but that was the race plan, keep on her tail. And the 200 metres comes and it goes and I step up my gear and I try and overtake her, but she reacts. So she goes up her next gear and I'm like thinking, Simmons, this is what I'm saying to myself. I'm like, what am I going to do? You know, Billy told me this and I was supposed to overtake her, but it's not happened. Like, what am I going to do? But in that mind, in one thing I could do would distract myself and think, oh gosh, this plan hasn't worked. Panic, panic, panic. But I was like, focus, Simmons. Like, you know what it is. Eight lengths of the pool. That's easy. What you do every single day. You love swimming. You've done all this in the past. You've got the experience. And the last 50 metres of the 400 metres, all of a sudden, this next gear goes. So she's beating me. The last 50 metres, finally, I touch first, tumble turn first. And I remember thinking, this is the last 50 metres. I'm exhausted. Energy's gone. Like, I'm tired. But sometimes that will to win, that something we've all got in us, innate in us, like that passion, the love of something. It came out and I remember thinking, head down, just go for it, just smash it. Like, and at the time, I thought we were close to close, but looking back, I was actually quite ahead of her. And I remember touching and thinking, wow, it's over. That's what my relief was, more the fact that it's done. And then looking back and I hit a PB, personal best and a world record and gold medal. And it's funny, Billy always said it was going to be a 1 in a 5:19. I never thought that was going to be 1 in a 5:19, but it was 1 dead on 5:19. And yeah, the crowd went wild. It was incredible. So all that pressure, all that had just gone out the window, and you're just in elation. You're just, it's the most incredible feeling ever. It's like a drug. Like, you just feel like unstoppable. Like, it's hard to describe the feeling of all that hard work, all those training, all those moments of getting up when it's dark, wet hair, smelling of chlorine, being selfish, being able to not be able to go to friends, things, weddings, all of that was just for this moment. And to be an American and beat one of your main rivals who you've never raced before was just, yeah, a massive confidence boost. And then you go through media, and then you have to do drugs testing. So that's like back down to solid ground where you have to wee in front of someone. And then you do the medals and you sing the national anthem, and you just, yeah, it's such a euphoric feeling.
Because I'm right in thinking it was a bit of confusion over whether she would even race at all, which must have added a whole other element. You're not sure if this person who is your main competitor in the race is even going to be in the race.
Oh, yeah, very much. So there was one day, so classification with the Paralympics, we're all classified due to our disability, and swimming, there's S1 to S10. So S1 is the most severe, S2 is the least severe, and I'm an S6, and Victoria Ireland got put in an S6, but because of her disability, it wasn't stable, so it was hard to measure what classification she was going to be in. So one day she was going to be allowed to race, the next day she wasn't allowed to race. So I remember thinking each day, am I going to race her? Am I not? But me and Billy would just chat and be like, if she's there, she's going to push her to a fast time. If she's not, she's not. Like, you can't control her. So we just tried to not use that as a distraction, and just, yeah, we spoke about it because we didn't want to ignore it, because if you ignore it, then it can fester in your mind. But I knew that if I was going to race her, I was in my prime. I was feeling amazing. I knew I'd done everything that I could do. And if she beats me, she beats me. But I'm controlling myself, and I'm in the best position that I'm putting myself in for to give her a tough race. So I was hoping she was going to be in, because I wanted to race her. Because, yeah, again, it's that competitive, yeah, spirit.
I mentioned to you before we actually started recording, we had Dame Kelly Holmes on the previous season of the show, and she talked about winning her first gold and how during the race she felt something special, like she entered a state of mind she'd never previously had during any race ever. I think she described it as having angel wings, like pick her up and lift her, and that contributed to her winning that gold. Did you enter a similar state of mind at all?
Yeah, oh, very much so. And I've only ever experienced that feeling twice. And it's something that you can't train. It's something that you can't pull out. It happens naturally. It's like this will to win, this passion, this love, this extra burst, this extra energy that you can't pick, you can't tell it to come out, it just comes out. And it came out on that last 50 of the 400 metres in London 2012. And it's so hard to describe, it's so hard to pinpoint what it is, but it's, yeah, this just extra, it's the love for it, it's this extra euphoric feeling. And it happened in the 400 metres in London, and it happened in the 200 metres IM in Rio 2016, that last race. I've never been able to pick it since. I don't know why. I wish I could. I wish I knew how to enter it, but
time for a top-up courtesy of our sponsor, Laurent Perrier. Since the 1950s, Laurent Perrier has been crafting wines with freshness, finesse, and elegance, always designed to pair beautifully with French cuisine. Whether it's a champagne aperitif or a wine to accompany a carefully prepared meal, Laurent Perrier has always been a trusted companion to chefs and gourmets alike, including right here at the Savoy, elevating every dish. Laurent Perrier Heritage is a true pleasure wine, perfect to enjoy in good company, over great conversation, or alongside some thoughtfully chosen food. The pairings are almost endless. Tender poultry, noble fish, shellfish like langoustine or spider crab, and even mushrooms all find the perfect partner in Heritage. With Laurent Perrier, every sip is a celebration. Every meal, an occasion, and the possibilities, well, they're limitless. So here's to a tradition of great taste on the plate and in the glass. And to Laurent Perrier for setting the standard for elegance and innovation today. Cheers. London 2012 was huge. I think you've described the Rio Paralympics it's slightly differently. Going into those games, your fitness, I think you said, was the best it's ever been, but your mental health was the worst it's ever been prior to a major event, to the point that had you actually thought about maybe not competing in Rio?
I remember just having so many panic attacks, I was so down on myself, so low, just not right at all. I'd swam for so many years, all I knew was being a Paralympian. I'd missed so much of that growing up stage. I'd missed, when normally at your school, you go to your prom, you go out, you figure yourself out. Like, throughout my growing up stage, I was on the road all the time. I was competing at the highest level. I was coping with the pressure of all that. I just missed a massive chunk of childhood and figuring myself out away from the pool. So that, and also after London 2012, British Swimming decided to close the High Performance Centre of Swansea. So it meant that a lot of us had to move, and Billy lost his job with British Swimming and he moved to China, it's incredible for him, but it meant that I had to move, and I moved to the High Performance Centre in Manchester, which I thought was a good move, but actually mentally was very detrimental due to one of the coaches there being not good at all, not a nice human, and very much putting us in not good positions and not having, believing in us, and just, it was a bullying environment and knocking your confidence hugely. And for me, I believe I have got massive self-belief in myself when I was a swimmer, but also when people believe in me, that helps me. And when you've got someone that is knocking you down, knocking your confidence hugely, my self-belief in my swimming just was all-time low. So there were so many factors going into Rio why, mentally I just wasn't in the right shape. Like, it was one of my most fun games with the social aspect, because I remember I was 21, so I could go out all the time. Like, as soon as the swimming finished, I could go out and party and stuff. But it was, a weird games as well. I was ready for it to be over. And I don't know how I got the gold medal in the 200 IM or the bronze in the 400 metres free. Like, it was just, again, having the experience of other Paralympics and the training behind my back, I think that helped. But I think if I was mentally like I was in 2012 with the self-belief and the belief from all the environment around me, I think I would have probably been, maybe got more medals in Rio, but and gone a lot faster in the 200 IM. But mentally I struggled. So that's why I decided to, after Rio, take a year out from the sport and go traveling. And it was probably one of my best years I've ever had. Like, it was so much fun, because all that time, all those years of, not saying I loved those times, I enjoyed every single second, but you knew where you got to be every single day. So to finally, as a 21-year-old, have a break and just be able to wake up and think, where in the world am I going to go today? Like, I just was able to not get recognised, I did lots of volunteering, went to South Africa, like, went everywhere, and was just able to figure myself out and just get my confidence back in me and just find Ellie the person rather than be Ellie Simmons the swimmer.
I think the British Swimming actually did issue an apology in the end for the behaviour of that coach, because by all accounts they did create a climate of fear.
Oh, very much so, hugely. Like, I wouldn't wish how he treated us as athletes and as humans on anyone. Literally, it was horrible. And it's crazy to think he can still coach now. Like, athletes are finally having the opportunity, with the support of others, to be able to voice how their treatment, and it should have been like that in the past. We should have been able to use our voice and not be treated the way that we did.
Let's talk about your time out and deciding after your time out, after going traveling, which sounds like an amazing experience, and exploring that side of Ellie Simmons. Was there any question about doing Tokyo?
So I had my excitement, I had my fabulous year, and then August, I knew it was ready. It was a year. It was ready to get back in the pool. I think one I found my love for the swimming back. And I went and saw Billy in China and I had a couple of weeks with him, and he was like, I'm actually moving back too. So it fitted perfectly to get back in the water, then back with Billy as well, my coach that I'd gone to London and Beijing with. So, and also I wanted to finish on a high. Rio wasn't a high. It was a weird games. Again, I spoke about it mentally and stuff. So I knew that I wanted to finish on a high, and I knew that Tokyo was going to be an amazing games. Looking back now, it was different because of COVID, but at the time we didn't know that COVID was going to come around. But yeah, I was ready both physically and mentally to get back, because I think having that year out, I realised how much I love swimming and how much the amazing opportunities it gave me. But then also I wanted to channel my competitiveness back into the swimming world.
So after Tokyo, you make the big decision after a truly phenomenal career. Having achieved so much, you decide, I'm ready to retire. Before we catch up on ourselves to the here and now and your post-swimming career, obviously, this is the Savoy Original. So I want to ask you, with all the experience that you have, the knowledge you've gleaned from your illustrious sporting career that has seen you become a truly original talent with a trophy case to prove it, what has it taken for you to carve out that place in history?
Ooh. Lots of things. I wouldn't be where I am today without the support of my parents and my coach Billy. But then there's a lot of sacrifices that you make to become a professional athlete, and even like moving away from my dad and my family home at the age of 12 to move to Swansea to our high performance centre. Sometimes I know me and my dad look back and think, oh, we missed a lot of growing up, but together, because he was at work all the time, and we were in Swansea, me and my mom, and we would drive home to Birmingham on the weekends. So a lot of things. But again, I think the love for what you do, having a purpose to wake up for, was my swimming and my friends that I created from that, the team atmosphere, the opportunities to represent my country, travel, to go. We were abroad a lot, racing, training. Like, I've loved everything that I've done in my career, and I think having the love for it is, and the passion really, really helps.
So with how all-encompassing your swimming career has been, how did the future look to you when you made that decision to retire? Was there ever, I guess, a fear of going, if I'm no longer competing as a world-class athlete, you know, who am I?
Oh, yeah. You know, I was excited because I could wake up and not have to wake up on a 4:45 alarm. Like, that's one thing I was so excited for. But also, it's a scary feeling because you've lost your sense of purpose too, because I knew what my plan was when I was a swimmer. I had a 4-year plan, year plan, week plan, day plan. And all of a sudden, that plan goes out the window. And I knew I was Ellie Simmons, the swimmer. But actually, what else was I good at? Because I'd never had a job before. I never had to do a CV. All this, like, it was all new. And yes, that was so exciting because I have some amazing opportunities. Like, I knew that I could try lots of different things. And I had the time as well to try these different things. But also, it was scary because there was too much choice. There was too many options because I didn't know what I wanted to do. So yeah, I think it was hard, but it was also exciting too. And I thought I had a plan. Like, I thought, well, did I have a plan? Well, I don't know if I did have a plan.
I was going to say, is there someone there, I mean, who helps you at that point? You know, you've a world-class athlete, and then I've given that up. Does someone go, well, here's a roadmap, Ellie. These are the options available to you at this stage. This is what someone who's achieved what you've done could potentially go on to do. Is there someone there guiding you?
There is when you're an athlete.
But afterwards,
it's funny because you have support for the first 2-3 months. But after a Paralympics, you're normally enjoying all the enjoyment of the success that you go on. So the time that you get that 3 months, you're not really focusing on things. And that's the weird thing, that when you are retired, the support system that you've had throughout your life of having all these people to help you, all of a sudden disperses. And yes, Billy, I speak to my coach. He's my best friend. I see him regularly. I talk to him most days. But all the other aspects of the physio, mental health, all that has all goes. And that's odd. That's one of the weird things, is that you've had this support system throughout your life, all of a sudden disperses. And yes, I think there's probably options to choose and to help, to have someone to speak to with lifestyle and figuring out a plan. But I think I just wanted to figure it out myself and just see where in the world it would take me.
At one of the places it took you is obviously still one of the biggest shows on TV, Strictly Come Dancing, which you did in 2022. I think how was that experience? By all accounts, you loved it. It's a lot of exposure, and an exposure, I guess, in a different way to something that you've been in control of with your swimming.
Oh, yeah. Like, I love dancing. I loved it when I was a kid, and I love dancing at like weddings and on a Saturday night and all that. So to be able to learn how to dance with a professional athlete and to see that other side or that other world, like, I'm used to swimming and having wet hair and, you know, smelling of chlorine and not wearing makeup, all that. So to learn all this new stuff about the makeup world and the hair world and the costume team and all that, like, it was just incredible opportunity. And like, you're thrust into the spotlight, which it was hard. Like, definitely there's pros and cons to that. You've got critics, you're competing against people who've may have dancing experience, and I was new to dancing world and all that type of stuff. Like, yeah, it was, but again, I made some amazing friends from it. Richie Anderson, who I do Gogglebox with, and I speak to every single day, and like Jesse, who's from the makeup team, we've become best friends. So get some incredible opportunities from it, and I loved it. Like, I love dancing, and it's made me love dancing even more.
I mentioned this already before we started, that I happened to be in the room in the audience seeing you win the BAFTA in 2024 for your documentary Finding My Secret Family. This is you deciding to look for and speak to your birth mother. And first of all, I guess, then this kind of goes back to the question of whether you had a roadmap for your career post swimming. Was this something that you were like, this is something I want to do, this is a documentary I want to make, I'm going to approach, I don't know, ITV or Flickr Productions? Or was it the other way around? Did they come to you and go, listen, we think there's a story here, we'd like you to make this documentary? Which way around does it happen?
So how it happened was, I did a documentary with the BBC, A World Without Dwarfism, straight after Tokyo. And I spoke with them about, I'm thinking about going on this journey of finding my birth mum, and I was going to do it away from the cameras. And then me and Colleen, who's head of Flickr Productions, we just chatted and spoke openly about what about if we do it in a documentary. And then we spoke to ITV, and they were like, yes, let's document it as well. So it was mainly focused on me. But again, I think that's one of the things since doing documentaries, and is having that trust. And we were with Colleen and the production company, but also ITV, the support that they gave us and me, and such a personal story. Because even looking back, I got the first draft. There was stuff that I didn't want in. Mm. And for them to be all right, like, yes, we're not having that in, and to respect, like, not seeing my birth mom as well. We wanted to keep her protected and keep her not on TV and keep that moment between me and her. Like, we didn't have any of, it was just me and her in that room meeting each other for the first time. We didn't want it to be documented, or we didn't want anyone to be in there with us, and for them to respect that as well. So I think we've got a really great relationship, and I fully trust them. And then we've done another documentary since with ITV. And I felt also being given this opportunity to document it was an opportunity to not just to find out more about myself and fostering, but also I find with documentaries, you're on this journey of education. I was able to follow like social workers in Essex and to meet families who had gone through the adoption process. So in a way, like, yes, you're learning about yourself, but I find you're educating yourself. And that's what I love about doing documentaries, because in a selfish way, you're learning about the world and educating yourself.
Finding My Secret Family, it doesn't need me to tell you, it won a BAFTA. It's a fantastic piece of television, an emotional journey for you with some astonishing moments and revelations in it. And I can't recommend it enough if anyone hasn't seen it. When it came to meeting your birth mother, though, and did it live up to the expectation you had? Because obviously it's a huge moment for you. Was it everything you'd hoped it would be? Did you get from it what you'd perhaps expected to get from that meeting?
Yeah, and more. I met Jono, who was on the documentary, who wasn't able to meet his birth parents because, again, they didn't want to meet him. So I was prepared for that to happen. I was prepared for maybe my mom, dad might have passed away, all this type of stuff, which at the time, before going on it, I never thought about all of this, but going on the journey, it started to make me think about this. The first time I was actually supposed to meet her, I was so nervous. I got a migraine, and when I get migraine, I get the aura as well, so I'll be sick and all that. So with all the nerves, I actually couldn't meet her.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because I had a migraine and I was so like nervous. So I had to organize a meeting again. So when I did meet her, I was so nervous, like so, so nervous. And I had all these questions in my head, and we went into a neutral place. So somewhere that's not connected to both of us. And when we met each other, I was saying to my, I had a support worker with me, and I said to Glesny, let's just meet for 15 minutes. That's all I want to meet her for. Literally, I want to ask her a few questions and then leave. So Glesny was like there to help me. And next thing you know, I met my birth mom, and it was 6 hours. We ended up chatting for 6 hours. And it was like, just, I'd spoken to someone that was just like a friend. Like, we were having so many laughs, and I think it was amazing. But I've been so lucky, because I know that so many people who have gone through this journey like that I have haven't got their happy ending. So if anyone's listening on this podcast, that yes, I got my joyful, amazing experience, but I'm rare.
As well as these documentaries telling powerful stories and raising important issues, I'm imagining on a personal level for you, they provide you with some validation in your post-swimming career. It's something to focus on, to be validated by. Would that be fair?
Yeah, very much so. And what I love now with this career in this next chapter is it's so the total opposite of my swimming career. It's like every single day is different. And I never would have thought 4 years later since retiring that I'd be this busy and this, like, just even chatting to you today on this podcast in the Savoy Hotel, like, you see the Savoy and you see, like, podcasts, and you never think that you're going to be able to be on one and even be at the hotel. So, like, it's just, yeah, I'm just so thankful for every opportunity that I'm getting, and it's wonderful. And to meet so many different people, it's just, yeah, lovely.
And I guess the other thing that, when we talk about validation, for right or wrong, I guess we're talking about happiness and really what makes us happy now, and whether seeking validation from whatever, whether it's a swimming career, whether it's TV, whether it's what I do, what you do, whether that is something that we should rely on for happiness, the need for validation. So I guess that the question I'm asking is what really makes you happy? What gets you out of bed in the morning and puts a smile on your face?
It's funny. I think finally I've figured it out. But I think beforehand it was the praise of, like, the gold medals. That's what I was used to seek validation in, knowing that I was good in the water or, like, in the TV world, like, doing well, and the credits that you get with all of that. Whereas now, I finally, this year, I feel like I've had the moment to be okay slowing down.
That's almost our time, Ellie. We are going to end on three quickfire questions to finish off our time together. We have made our way through a tiny portion of your achievements today, but what is it in your career that you are truly most proud of?
Oh, can I have two, or is it?
You can have two.
My first one is the gold medal in the 400 meters free in London 2012. Would just be something that I'll never ever forget. And then the BAFTA for the documentary, just because, again, it's a subject close to my heart. And since speaking about my adoption, I feel like so many people have spoken to me and had the confidence to talk about adoption and to open that subject, and for people to feel confident that they can talk about it. That, yeah, I feel I'm very proud of that.
Okay, tell me the most valuable skill you have ever learned, the one that changed your way of doing things.
To be on time is to be late. So, like, trying to manage time, yeah, that's a skill that I've learned. Like, having my clocks are always early, so I'm never going to be late. I'm always going to leave the house early.
I do exactly the same.
Yeah.
My watch is always 10 minutes fast, because yeah, I'm always on time then.
Yeah, I love being on time.
Finally, can you give us one piece of advice that you'd hand to someone else wanting to follow in your footsteps?
Find something that you love and that you're happy. My coach, Billy Pye, always used to say, a happy swimmer is a fast swimmer. So making sure that you're happy with not just being in the water or your sport or your profession, but making sure that you manage your happiness away from work life and normal life and everyday life, that really hones into your career, really.
Ellie, it's been absolutely fascinating going on this journey with you. That is the end of our time together. So all that's left to do is say thank you very much and cheers once more.
Yeah, thank you. I need to drink more. I love this.
Thank you. And that is it. A big thank you to our producer, Matt Hill at Rethink Audio, to our sponsor, Lauren Perrier, and of course to Ellie Simmons for coming in today. Join me again next week when we'll be once more opening up the Savoy's Little Black Book and welcoming another celebrated guest to ask them what it takes to be a true original. Until then, follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye-bye for now.